papers on these LLMs. I'll just use them as an example. People are coming up with all kinds of band-aid approaches to try to build trust. So people will probably still keep trying to come up with band-aids. To Reid's point, people who actually know how this technology works will do something deeper than a filter on the outside in order to try to help us better understand trust. There's a part of generative AI that will always be able to manipulate us. And I'll give you an example as to why I say that. So I was the chief technology officer at the Federal Trade Commission. And one of the things that I learned there is what will make people turn over their life savings to a stranger or get their parents to, not only they turn over their life savings, but their parents' life savings and their children's life savings too. And it has to do online when you are in community with a small group that shares a lot of the intersections with you. The more intersections that group shares with you, the more you trust them. Generative AI has the ability to build trust just between the AI and myself, right? That it understands me. And as a human, we can keep it at a distance by saying, these are the only tasks I'm using you for, dude. You stay over there. Listen, I will just ask you for these things. But the minute you find yourself, and you may not even always know that you're in conversation with, it's going to be huge. How do you build trust? Because you will definitely trust it in a way that you might not trust many humans.
Right. That's the flip side. Too much trust.
Yeah, that's a new kind of vulnerability we have. And the issue of trust in this rise of generative AI is absolutely huge. It is the right question because there are just so many aspects of that trust. We have to redo everything now. I go online to Amazon and I want to buy something and I'm looking at the reviews. Now, did humans write those reviews or did a generative AI write those reviews?
Or, by the way, did humans who are paid by a corporation write those reviews? I mean, there's a whole stack here.
With an AI. Right.
Yes.
Right. A human says, write 10 versions of this. Right. So all of a sudden, you know, things that I trusted before, like we can start making a list of what are the things I can't trust anymore. Right. And then online. So we got these amazing LLMs because, in fact, it reviewed all the stuff we put online that's publicly available and even semi-publicly available. And most of that was human generated. Almost all of it was human generated. But because it's so good at regurgitating and remixing and regurgitating back the remix version and so forth, you know, in a couple of years, most of the online content is going to be AI generated. And then all of a sudden, it changes our notion of trust of online content.
Well, speaking on the trust side, this actually gets to another of the questions that I was looking to ask you. And it's funny because I asked Inflection, the AI company that I co-founded as Chatbot Pi, what key element should be incorporated into a new social contract that ensures technology upholds democratic values? Because I knew I was talking to you, so I'd start with Pi and get there. And Pi said,
transparency, clear and open communication about how technology is being used, who is using it, and for what purposes is essential. Accountability. Those who develop and use technology should be held responsible for its impacts on society. Equity. Technology should be accessible to all members of society, regardless of their social or economic status. Privacy. Individuals should have control over their personal data and how it is used. Human-centered design. Technology should be designed with the needs and values of humans in mind.
I love that answer. I wonder who it stole it from.
Yes, exactly. Might have trained on someone that we're talking to, possibly.
So I love that answer. The thing that I find funny is, and then if I ask Pi, all right, Pi, exactly how did you come to know this? It will probably answer with, well, I know. It'll give you a nice full-throated answer. And of course, it's not being transparent or honest. It's doing the best it can.
As you know, these LLMs, the basic thing is they're generative.
Yeah.
Which you could say is great at essentially imagining or hallucinating, but they're trying to be constrained to answers that it thinks you want to hear, which
yeah.
We're trying to train it in ways of saying, yes, truthful. helpful, right, is how we're trying to constrain that set of capabilities.
You know, truthful doesn't mean the same as what we mean. To the point that I'm continuing to personify now Pi, there is a kind of, the communication is missing each other. What we're after for truth is debatable sometimes. Its notion of truth is totally different.
Well, I think, like, again, this social contract is at the heart of what we want for technology. We want technology to serve humans' ends. We want technology to make all of our lives better. And, you know, sometimes the market gets it right. Like, I think, honestly, I think about it every single time I ride a city bike in New York City. The back-end technology for city bike is Lyft. And I am so grateful and thankful that Lyft exists and that technology helps me ride a bike instead of drive a car or whatever it might be. And you are one of the, you know, the pioneers of public interest technology. Can you talk about, you know, your favorite real world examples of where you saw technology successfully implemented, you know, to address a particular social change, or where you think public interest technology sort of did it best?
So in the spirit of the Weld experiment, I teach students how to do this, and then they do this at scale. And the work that they've done has gone on to change laws and regulation and business practices. And one of my favorite examples of that is, in fact, Airbnb. A professor here at Harvard had shown that host on Airbnb in New York City, if you were a Black host and a white host and you were offering comparable properties, the Black host made about 12% less, because that was what the market would bear, if you will. And so students wanted to do a more rigorous one. Example, they chose Oakland and Berkeley, California, and they were able to show that Asian hosts made 20% less than white hosts for comparable property. So Airbnb, of course, sends their attorneys forward and so forth, and then they changed their platform. So if you rent on Airbnb today, they set the price. And part of setting the price is to make sure that that side effect doesn't happen. So many kudos for them. We've done a lot of these kinds of experiments where we've been able to find places where a societal norm is conflicting with technology. How do we keep the technology? How do we fix the norm? That would be an example. You mentioned bikes. I just want to say, one of my students, so bicycle sharing had the problem that when you would go to a station, there might not be any bicycles there. Or when you go to a station, there's no place to put your bicycle. So one of my students, Drew, came up with a fantastic algorithm to solve that problem. And it's been used in cities around the country. So anyway, I'm just telling you, there's a zillion low-hanging problems to which students can address. And that's part of what we do in public interest tech as well.
I love it. And I think it's so important because it's something I struggle with because, you know, the underlying technology might not be racist or sexist or whatever. And there's no ill intentions from the technologist. But when it bumps up against real world discrimination, it creates this outcome. And so I think we need to get to a place where we're not accusing anyone of anything. We're just saying, like, now that we know, we have a duty to fix it.
And this takes us back to the earlier part of our discussion around these three pillars of democracy, republic, and capitalism. So when they're out of sync, we got the leaked Facebook documents that Frances Haugen produced, and we made them public on fbarchive.org. But one of the things that jumped out at me right away from them was how badly they do content moderation. The second thing that jumped out at me is, and we don't know how to do it any better. In other words, this is clearly a computer science problem that no computer science school or group of thinking has really started to address. Why? Because it's inside of the silo of a capitalist company who has a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. And so they don't want their bottom line affected. But somehow we've got to find a way that it's okay to say, I don't know how to do this. Here's money or whatever. Can we get 1,000 great minds to work on how do we do content moderation better, for example? Instead, we're moving towards, we're not going to do content moderation. That's not okay.
One of the things that I've been trying to kind of get to is, we'd like you to be solving this problem better. And here is like what the metrics might be if you were iterating to it from within, you know, your company. So for example, because your attention algorithms are increasing agitation, you know, hatred, other kinds of things, we'd like you to baseline kind of like what is kind of a reasonable agitation metric. And then I want you to be measuring your dashboards of how your algorithms are working and promoting and making sure you're not overly increasing it. That's one. How would you think about for content moderation, misinformation, fake news, other kinds of things? Like, how would you think about trying to kind of facilitate the, hey, if you were doing X, Y, and Z, inventing technology for it, because, you know, to have it be a invention loop, a reasonable economics loop, what would be the gestures you'd make?
So, Reed, the word I loved the most of all the words you said was metric. Set a bar and let's see how you can get to this bar. Because on the one hand, if you're the company, you have a fiduciary responsibility. You're trying hard not to screw up your money machine. And I mean that in an affectionate way, not as some kind of hypercritical complaint. But I mean, that's what they're supposed to be doing, right? So they don't want to mess that up. So they're not quick to want to come forward with how the sausage is made and where the sausage problems might be. But on the other hand, when the sausage is having a problem, that's where that problem is causing a societal harm, I don't want to come in and say you have to do X, Y, Z. When government does that, it's not actually working at its best, and it's not actually good because they can miss it either way, and society doesn't get the best benefit of the technology, or the society may get even worse problems, and the company has a sort of carte blanche to do so. So instead, it's much better to set metrics. Metrics that say, we didn't realize teenage girls were having this problem. Now that we know this, this is what you've got to guarantee, or this is the promise that you have to make, or this is the minimum, and you need to show us that you're doing that. The companies, though, unfortunately, they don't like metrics because they much rather have a rule, right? They'll tell you, well, if we just put a notice, is that good enough? So they want a out-of-bounds solution because that's easier for them. So a metric is painful for them too.
Yeah, I think that may be foolish because the problem is if we're giving them rules, what we really need is metric outcomes. The rules are going to be so crude as to be very damaging to all kinds of outcomes. For example, you say, look, content moderation, a publishing house will say, you must hire tons and tons of editors to do editing all this content moderation. That's just like, oh my God, that's not going to work. And that's part of the reason why, you know, they fight so hard on this topic, where you say, well, actually, these are the metrics that we're trying to look for out of content moderation. Can you innovate on your technology to be within these metrics? And obviously, we might move and modify them. And as long as you're dynamic over time and kind of improving them, which would be part of good governance on this, and they don't have to be necessarily even publicly revealed. They could be measured through auditors and discussions. This would be a far healthier dynamic position to be in, which is one of the reasons why this is exactly what I try to tell government regulatory people. This is the kind of thing that we should be talking about.
Yeah, but think about it this way. We've been talking about generative AI. If content moderation is just a set of practices, I have a checklist of things I do, I make sure somebody saw this, I make sure my counts are this or that, then we still get bad content moderation. If content moderation is a metric and it's cheaper for me to do it by training an AI to do it, all of a sudden we get innovation right at the place where we need it the most. Not innovation for content moderation coming from the outside. As you point out, they know their technology and their company functioning better than anyone else, but to incentivize them to spend a resource on that is really important.
You know, I agree that if we have the government making these regulations, then the key is to have that metric that a company can strive for however they like. And to your point, maybe they come up with a new chatbot that does it for them. We want it to be as cheap as possible to comply with these regulations. But in the absence of government regulation, how do we foster a greater sense of social responsibility within the tech sector? Like Airbnb, you said you gave them the findings and they changed. There was no law. What do you think the levers are if there is no, in the absence of government regulation, to get some of this, you know, sort of more positive technology into the world?
It is a series of things that have to be put in place. Some of it is a sense of responsibility. I mean, if social media was financially responsible for some of the harms that people are experiencing, that's one way to incentivize them quickly to find solutions. Sometimes the answer might be a legal answer like that. It might be setting a metric with fines or embarrassment. I think all of these things play a role. But the most important thing is the point that you're making is it's all about how do I get them to be more responsible to society for the harms that their technology may be producing.
So I asked this question with a little bit of nervousness, but I think it's good in this context. I usually take a lot of pride in LinkedIn being much better on all these issues than other social networks. Any commentary on LinkedIn, how we should improve other things? It's always important to do. And here I am talking to an expert, so I figured might as well ask.
So Reid, I just have to tell you straight up, you know, I admire you that you would ask me that question in a recording.
Truth and improvement really matters.
In my class, I have this chart of these long lists of laws and regulations. And I say, look, people died and fought for these laws. And let's go visit them and see how they're no longer possible to be enforced. So one of them that LinkedIn shows up on the list has to do with employment. So when recommendations are made to employers, I'm just going to say, because it's not just a LinkedIn thing, it's any group who has a large set of resumes, there's a business opportunity to recommend to an employer who might be a good candidate. And so I say, yeah, I want to hire some people. So the first group you give me, I say, oh, I like these, I don't like these. And the system is going to learn my preferences over time. But my preferences might be that I don't want women, or my preferences might be a discrimination against age. And all of the ways that we would have detected that before happening at scale, we can't do in that closed conversation, that closed loop. And so this is a place where that's, we need the technology to make that assurance to us.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, well, yeah, I did learn their preference, but their preference is going too far one way. So I'm just going to automatically keep pushing in some of these others.
Well, one of the things that Reid and I have been talking a lot about lately is agency. And so you might know Reid recently wrote this new book called Super Agency. And the idea of super agency is when like millions of people get simultaneous access to new technological breakthroughs. And so it has those network effects. So it doesn't just benefit you. It benefits everyone around you. And everyone around you having that additional agency benefits you even more. I love how you are both a techno-optimist, but you very much, you know, see the harms and want to make sure that they're equally applied to everyone so that everyone can benefit. When you think of agency and super agency, perhaps in particular in the age of AI, how do you think it could be applied to education? How could you use it as a professor in the classroom? How can Harvard use it? You've spent a long time in academia. What does AI mean for the next wave of education?
Oh, what a fantastic question. Oh my God. So I had the opportunity to lead the college in trying to get its head around what to do with generative AI. And of course, it means rethinking our classes and how we teach and how we learn. So in some classes, the ability to have to interact with the AI, to interact with an LLM and so forth, as a perspective, I mean, in a philosophy class, being able to say, driverless cars, what would Immanuel Kant think about driverless cars, right? What about, how would you apply dialectical logic to the, and then the students can argue whether or not they agree with that interpretation or not. The ways in which this can be done is amazing. So the opportunities are there. It requires a total rethinking. How do students learn to write or program? Because, you know, because I can ask an LLM, could you write me a program that does my assignment? And so it makes us also have to think about, there are times where we want these students to develop a particular skill, but also, what is the future like when they go to a job? Are they going to, if they get hired as a programmer, does their boss want them sitting there writing the code from scratch when they could build on the shoulder of an LLM to give them the first draft? Helping my colleagues begin to navigate what is this and what does it mean was a huge honor, actually. And it's been exciting to see the new uses that it's been put to. Of course, the students are always one step ahead.
Well, speaking of students, any recent insights that you may have gained from your students?
You know, it's really interesting. I live with 420-year-olds. So I also have a role as a faculty dean. This is my ninth year doing this. And they give me so much hope for the future. So much hope. They're amazing people. They have, you know, you forget what it was like to be 20 and where you're trying to figure out what you're going to keep and what you're going to throw away and who you are, but also just the energy and boldness that many of them exhibit is quite refreshing. It's fascinating to me when I get discouraged and so forth sometimes to just have a conversation with them and them see a different kind of light or a different kind of way forward. Do they see problems? There's a long list. In fact, there's a group of 30 students who are organized who don't even take my class. They just want to meet and talk about issues. So it's very much on their mind. If I were to go back 20 years ago, students were interested in my privacy class too, but they didn't feel the same kind of urgency and they didn't feel the same kind of passion and they didn't feel the same kind of need. I do think the students today, their eyes are much wider open.
I mean, you have students who want to take a class with you. It's not even a class. I think that's a good sign. I think you're doing something right.
I think we're good to move to rapid fire. So I will start. Is there a movie, song, or book that fills you with optimism for the future?
Well, I just got through reading a book called Queen Bess. It excites me for the future because it's a bit political in a time where at least 40% of our country is caught up in political concern. And it asks the question, who would you bring from the past to help you navigate the future? And in this particular author, her answer was Queen Elizabeth, right? The first, who like ran Britain through all these rough times. You know, and then you put her in today's setting, what would she say? What would she do? So I find it very delightful.
That is actually a great rapid fire question. I feel like I want to ask so many people that. Like that's a great cocktail party question. Who would you bring from the past to help navigate the future?
Absolutely. So where do you see progress or momentum outside of your industry that inspires you?
Well, I'm inspired in my industry by AI, frankly. Yes, it's scary, a bold new future that at a time we're not ready for it. But on the other hand, what it might be capable of and where it might could take us is exciting, whether or not we actually get to that vision of utopia. I mean, in many ways, I'm still the graduate student having that conversation in the lounge with the ethicist that's trying to make good on that vision of technology.
I love it. And that brings us right to the final question perfectly. Can you leave us with a final thought on what you think is possible to achieve if everything breaks humanity's way in the next 15 years? And what's the first step to get there?
Oh, then I will have succeeded in my life mission of delivering to society the benefits of technology without the harms.
Amen.
That's awesome. LaTanya, great pleasure. I look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Possible is produced by Wonder Media Network. It's hosted by Aria Finger and me, Reid Hoffman. Our showrunner is Sean Young.
Possible is produced by Katie Sanders, Edie Allard, Sarah Schley, Vanessa Handy, Aaliyah Yates, Paloma Moreno-Jimenez, and Malia Agudelo. Jenny Kaplan is our executive producer and editor.
Special thanks to Surya Yalamanchili, Saida Sepieva, Thanasi Delos, Ian Alice, Greg Beato, Parth Patil, and Ben Rellis. And a big thanks to Max Boland, Joshua Shank, and Little Monster Media Company.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, welcome to Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and today I have Rachel Curry here with me. So specifically what I'm going to be talking about with you today is that you are a freelance journalist. So how did you go from like just an English major to actually working in news?
Yeah, so I attended the University of Delaware, and there I majored in English and minored in journalism. There was no journalism major at the school I attended, but I had the opportunity to spend some of my free time writing for the campus newspaper, specifically the lifestyle slash arts and entertainment section, which was more up my alley at the time. And it was a lot of fun, and it enabled me to, get exposed to different parts of campus life that I otherwise would not have. I also joined a literary publication club called Main Street Journal. And I know that people who are listening in aren't familiar with maybe the University of Delaware's ins and outs, but it was basically poetry, some short stories, photography, a lot of cool stuff. And I ended up being the editor-in-chief of that my senior year. And that gave me some experience just kind of putting something together and seeing a finished product, which was really rewarding. And I still have all of those books, which was really cool. Throughout my undergraduate experience, I feel like with a lot of creative people, you face older folks saying you should maybe take a little bit more of a conservative route to ensure that you're going to be financially stable in the future. And I was always balancing that. It was really difficult for me to figure out what avenue I wanted to head in. But I also know that I personally did not want to make my passion of more creative writing into a career, because I felt like it was going to drain me. So I ended up applying for a role as a copywriter right out of college, and I worked there for a year, and it gave me an opportunity to live in a new place and experience living on my own and not having the support of my community necessarily right around me, which I think was a good experience. It was also a really cool company and had a lot of interesting benefits like workout classes and things like that, pretty modern. However, I just did not feel fulfilled at the end of the day, and I ended up leaving that job after a year on good terms, but I had used that time to save up some money and ended up going traveling in Southeast Asia for about a year after that. And I did that partly because I wanted to travel with my partner, but also partly because it was like an affordable place to live and I could get some life experience before I had some like gnarly responsibilities. I also at the time had heard of this platform called Fiverr, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but it allows you to post your services on a freelance basis and people can buy them. And I know that some people are graphic designers selling logos to companies and things like that. I was really just writing, landing pages for people, sometimes blogs for their travel blogs and websites. So I started doing that while I was traveling, and honestly, just working on a tablet with like a little Bluetooth keyboard on a train or something. And it honestly kept me going. And by the time I came back, I wasn't necessarily like thriving financially, but I had at least more money than when I left. So I did seek full-time employment upon returning, but by that point it was getting close to the pandemic and things were a little crazy in the world. So I just kept trucking, kept going at my freelancing thing. And I ended up deciding to pursue it full time. So I formed an actual business, an LLC, around that time, and decided to stop looking for full time employment and just keep going with the freelancing. And for a while, it was a mix between local journalism with some local publications and lifestyle magazines in my area of South Central Pennsylvania, and a lot of content writing clients, which differs from journalism in that it's more branded and you've got some bias in there. You're trying to support the company that pays for it. Then I was offered the opportunity from a former professor of mine, Ben Yagoda, who is also an esteemed author. And he, while retired, was still hosting study abroad trips for journalism students from the University of Delaware. And I had attended one of his study abroads back in like 2016. He invited me to be a teacher's assistant for that trip. And despite the fact that I'm not a graduate student and never have been, I do have industry experience, at least about, I've done some travel writing and things like that. And that's what it was focusing on. It was based in Melbourne, Australia. So I went with him and did that. And teaching students the fundamentals of journalism and just getting back out there and experiencing, I guess, that idea of why I enjoyed it in college actually really inspired me to get back into it and focus less on branded content writing for companies. And it basically pushed me to make a big pivot and do more serious journalism. So for the past couple of years, that's what I've been doing. I was blessed to be able to go to Australia for this trip twice in a row, which was really exciting, and meet a couple of wonderful group of students and spend some time with them. And now, yeah, I write a lot about technology because that's always changing in the world. I write about local issues in my community and various other new subjects that land in my lap.
Awesome. So you said you write about technology. You also write about finance. You have a book about investing sustainably, apparently. How did you go from focusing on like more lifestyle content, like you were doing in college, to focusing on finance and tech?
Yeah. So as someone who's always been creative minded, my younger self would be completely surprised to see where I am today, but I think it's a good transition. I got really interested in finance when I went all in on freelancing. And the reason why is because I realized like, oh, I have to figure out how I'm going to save for retirement. And I don't have a company who's just allowing me to put money in to a 401k and forget about it. I actually have to make sure I'm doing this on my own so that way I'm not flailing in 40 years. And that doesn't sound super exciting, but in today's media landscape, I was able to find a ton of podcasts that I would listen to just when I'm walking my dogs. There was one in particular, the early episodes of Bad with Money, which is kind of who I was at the time. And I learned literally the basics of what the heck is a stock, and moving from there, I completely transformed my mindset in like a matter of a year or so. And I'm still learning, of course. There's so much complexity to the landscape, but I ended up getting connected with a couple of investing platforms who needed blog content for their sites, and I continued to learn more through my research. And then I started doing some journalism for publications relating to the financial industry. And the cool thing about journalism is that you become an expert by talking to other experts. And so half of my job is just coming up with questions and asking questions to people who really know what they're talking about and translating that for the general public. So it's kind of a win-win for me where I get this clip, but I also get to learn about really cool stuff that people are working on day in and day out. Now with the sustainable investing endeavor, that's just something I kind of do as a little bit of a passion project. And the reason why is because I'm always interested in bettering the world in some way. And I don't mean to sound like a martyr of any kind, but I think if we can prioritize our investments to decentralize things that we don't want to propel in the world, and instead focus on things that we think will help sustain a healthy planet and healthy people for longer, then why not do that? And you can still profit by doing so. And also with the investing for the environment stuff, I've given talks in my local community, like the neighborhood that I live in Lake Sur, Pennsylvania, has a climate action committee, and I've given a talk to them, and I've given a talk to my co-working space. So it's a pretty neat opportunity to just get to know people on a different level.
Wow. What would you say are the pros and also the cons of being freelance?
This is something that I'm always thinking about. The pros, number one, is flexibility in your day-to-day schedule. I have the opportunity, I consider myself a more of a fast writer than some people might consider themselves. And because of that, I'm able to finish my work and maybe go to the gym later in the day before my partner gets home from his 9 to 5, or finish my work and I think this afternoon I'm going to go to the SPCA and like spend a couple hours with the dogs there, which is something I like to do. And that's been a huge game changer for me. And I guess I'll use this opportunity to say that the hard and fast corporate life that you think you're facing post college isn't actually healthy for people of certain mindsets, in the sense that we all struggle with our mental health, and I think that comes first, and being able to prioritize my mental health and still make a living has been a huge game changer in my life. Now, a couple other pluses to that is that I don't have to wait for necessarily a promotion and a raise or an annual bonus in order to restructure my finances. I can upscale my clientele, whether it's writing for a larger, more nationally oriented publication like CNBC, or shifting the type of work that I do to something that I think aligns more with what I hope to achieve in the long term. With that said, most of my clients are, at this point, people I've been working with for years, but there are a few slots of available client space that I have that I am able to kind of rotate over time and shift the work I do to better align with the economy and what I hope to achieve in life. There are downsides, of course, like there are benefits that come with working for a company, literally benefits like healthcare. And right now I have to purchase that through the marketplace, even though I have a long-term partner who I own a home with, but because of the way America works, that I have to wait until I'm legally married to use his healthcare. So a lot of it is just logistics based in stuff that I can get past in life. I think that in the past, I would have said one of the downsides is that I work independently, which I like most of the time, but sometimes you want some community. But I'm very fortunate to now live in a place for the past couple of years that has a thriving co-working space and community. Like before hopping on this call with you this morning, I sat down with a group of women from my co-working space and we just chatted and caught up with each other and figured out what everyone's doing in their work and their life, and had some quiche, and it was great. Other than that, I honestly think that I worked for a company for 1 year out of college before transitioning to being self-employed, essentially, and seeing as how I've always been one to kind of buck trends and do things because I felt like they were the right thing to do, not because they were written in stone at school or something like that. It kind of makes sense that I'm here.
Yeah. So one thing that you also mentioned is that you write both for local publications and also for stuff on a much larger scale. What would you say is the difference between doing those two things?
There's a huge difference, but the fundamentals of journalism remain the same. For example, I write for my local daily, not all the time, but I used to cover municipal board meetings, which sounds riveting, I know, but it actually was a little bit interesting because I partnered on an investigative research when a township was seeking to halt library funding without informing residents. And so we were able to bring enough noise and attention to that, that they actually ended up reversing the decision because so many people made a fuss. And that was really interesting. Now, on the national level, I talk to more people from all over the world, and usually about topics that are really a little bit more than you'd find in a medium-sized city like I live in. For example, stuff that's going on in Silicon Valley, or stuff that relates to some sort of federal political landscape of some kind. And I think that the reason why I continue to do the local journalism and the regional journalism, it's not for the money. It's really to keep me grounded and connected with my local community, because when I'm covering, for example, I recently interviewed a new bookstore cafe owner who launched her business, and I got the opportunity to go there and sit with her and explore the space. And that's just not something you get to do for CNBC.
Yeah, that sounds like so fun. I also know that you won a 2024 Keystone Media Award for reporting on diverse businesses. Can you tell me a little about that one as well?
Yeah, so that was a surprise. I didn't know that my editor for The Berg magazine, a monthly publication out of Harrisburg, had sent in my article as part of a larger package that won that award. And it was one of those emails you receive and you're like, this feels like they didn't mean to CC me on this, which says a little bit about imposter syndrome, but that's a conversation for another day. When I eventually realized it was legitimate, I just felt like so excited, but also just really grateful that people are seeing and appreciating the work about all these really interesting, diverse businesses that are coming to the area. The particular piece that I wrote covered the grand opening of a cafe in Mechanicsburg outside of Harrisburg. And it is owned by the mother of a child with Down syndrome and is staffed completely by people with disabilities. And it was a really interesting place because they were not only prioritizing and advertising how friendly and diverse the staff is, but also just that it's a really cool place to sit and work or chat with friends, and it has great coffee and delicious food. So I enjoyed shedding light on that for sure.
How does say versus reporting on businesses end up differing?
Copywriting is writing copy or words for companies' websites generally, at least in the modern age. In the past, it might have been brochures, pamphlets. There's also technical writers who write instruction manuals and all that good stuff. I personally worked for a company that required me to write landing pages for car dealerships around the country. So I knew so much about cars during that year than I ever had before. And it was actually like an interesting thing to learn about. And the cool thing about being a writer of any kind is that you get to research all kinds of stuff. You kind of become like this vortex of facts, and it's a really cool party trick. But being a journalist is more balancing the size of the story with different perspectives. You're providing hopefully a more unbiased perspective. Obviously, there's going to be inherent bias in anything because of simply what we choose to include and who we choose to interview. But the idea there is to provide a more robust piece with different angles of perspectives that tells a bit more of the full story instead of just a puff piece or like an advertisement.
So what do you think are some current trends that you've noticed as you've been working in journalism?
One interesting trend that I've noticed recently is a lot of journalists are branching off and creating their own publications. Myself included, I have a newsletter where I'm covering some business topics that I haven't been able to pitch and place elsewhere. And it's just a place for me to be a bit candid and sometimes say curse words, which I think is more my vibe. But I also know that a lot of readers are becoming disillusioned with traditional media for whatever reason that may be. For example, when recent publications have made decisions about what they're going to publish based on the opinions of the billionaires that own those publications, it pushed a lot of subscribers out. And I know that a lot of journalists took advantage of that and were able to say, hey, you can sign up to my weekly or monthly newsletter and it comes right to your inbox. Maybe there's a payment for a subscription. Maybe there's tiers. Maybe it's based on ads. Maybe it's based on donations even, but generally people are really intrigued and excited by, it seems, kind of grassroots journalism right now. I know that I just subscribed to a newsletter that is written by people in prison and gives us a perspective of a world that we often only hear about from the outside. And I'm looking forward to receiving my first edition of that to see what that's all about. There's also another publication I'm part of called More to Her Story, which talks about the trials and tribulations of people, women specifically, around the world, oftentimes refugees or people in third world countries who are struggling to even gain an education. And I think it's cool to follow these more niche publications because it gives us a deeper dive into those perspectives. And another thing that's changing with journalism, I will say that there is another kind of hesitancy with the media that is approaching the more we get into this new administration, and I'm not really sure where that's going to head. For example, I know publications like Politico have recently been evicted from their post in the Pentagon and replaced with, for example, Breitbart News. And I think that does scare people a little. It scares me, I'll be honest, but I'm looking forward to seeing where the journalists are able to finagle their way through and get the details about what's going on in our country.
Well, you said that a lot of journalists now have newsletters. Do you think this is kind of a response to the fact that like smaller publications have been on a decline for the past 20 years or so?
I think that it's not necessarily a response to that, but more of a rewriting of where media is headed. For example, most of, I don't know the exact percentage, but most of the local daily newspapers in the United States are owned by Gannett or Gannett. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it's Australian-owned media corporation, and it really has taken away the independence of a lot of these publications. And naturally, in the digital age, paper readership is down. That's just going to be the case. And that's okay because there are so many avenues to get information to people digitally. A lot of people do still really want to read the written word, even if it's online, myself included. There's also a whole cohort of people who are voraciously consuming podcasts, also myself included. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to spend more time in quiet or something, but I like to consume media a lot. Then there's the people who are consuming news from oftentimes reputable reporters on TikTok. And this is just the nature of the modern age. I think that certain publications are slowly but surely coming around to that. Like, I know that the New York Times is creating more of a digital ecosystem than it ever has before. And when you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to bonus podcasts on Spotify and things like that. So in one way, it's just the natural order of things. And I think it's pretty cool that reporters are kind of scaling down, being more independent, and really taking the power back into their own hands.
Yeah. What's one thing that you're most proud of what you've reported on?
Well, I recently published an article on CNBC that focuses on how digital hiring assessments that people often have to take in order to even get to an interview stage in a company are largely not accessible for people with disabilities, despite the fact that many of them say they are. And I was able to speak to people with various disabilities, people who consult on this issue, people who research this issue, and figure out maybe what the next step is and why we need to restructure the digital hiring process. The interesting thing about that is that the Americans with Disabilities Act this year will be 30 years old. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that we've been living vastly online. And hiring online is even more recent. So a lot of these problems that people face who have disabilities are actually newer, even though there is accessibility in a lot more ways than we maybe have known in the past. There's kind of new ways that we have to fight against bias as well.
That's so interesting. So what is the advice that you'd give to a young person, maybe someone in college like me, who might be interested in going into journalism?
My advice is that even if you feel like you don't have the expertise to be reporting on something, just go for it anyway and ask a lot of questions. People get really excited when they're given the opportunity to answer questions, even if they might not seem like it at first. All you have to do is say, I'm a reporter, can I ask you some questions for such and such? Usually they let their guard down pretty quickly, even if there is a hesitancy at first, and it ends up working out really well. I would say, don't be afraid to push the status quo and ask the hard questions. I feel like a lot of the advice I'm giving is just don't be afraid. But despite the fact that the college experience gives you an opportunity to step outside of the box and try new things, there are ways that that opportunity may also try to confine you to pursue a certain path. And you really don't have to do that path if you don't want to. You can choose your own. And there's more options now than ever. You can work fully online. You can work remote from a post in Bali if you want. You don't have to do that forever, but I think it's, you know, after college, it's always a good time to try something like that. So I'll just say, you know, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Rachel Curry. I'm pretty active on there. I do have my newsletter called Acronym, which I'll be posting about all the time. And if you feel like you have a lead for a story, feel free to send me a message.
Thank you. This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I've been interviewing Rachel Curry. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and you're listening to From Here to Eternity, that show where we take a trip back to the 80s that you never knew. Well, today, we're going to just, you know, do the usual little mix of some things, but we're going to start off today with a song, because we're in spring right now. You know, I feel like, you know, in the spirit of the general springtime, you know, there really isn't any, I guess, Easter music. So we'll settle for spring. We're going to start off with this song here. It's yeah, excellent. I think it was entered into both Sanremo and Eurovision at the time. This is a tremendous song, personal favorite I've had on loop for quite some time. This is Maledetta Primavera by Loretta Goggi. We're going to do that right now.
Voglia di stringersi poi vino bianco, fiori e vecchie canzoni, e si rideva di noi che imbroglio era. Maledetta primavera che resta di un sogno erotico, se al risveglio è diventato un poeta, se a mani vuote di te non so più fare, come se non fosse amore, se per errore chiudo gli occhi e penso a te. Se
on the ice.